Welcome back. In this second episode, I'm thrilled to introduce my friend and co-host Jen, how we connected and subsequently bonded over shared interests, how learning together has led to a passionate and ongoing pursuit of new discoveries, and what we hope to share with you that sets us apart from the many incredible training and behavior podcasts that already exist. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore new perspectives on learning, behavior, and go beyond the black box.
Thanks, Sarah. I am so excited to be joining you on this adventure.
I couldn't be more excited to have you as co-host on this. And we should probably start with the biggest burning question, which is how the hell did we get here?
That is a great question. So glad you asked. I had to really think back as to how this evolved. Because while it hasn't been a lot of time, it took me a second to sort of think back through the different steps of like how we got here. So for me, it started in March of 22 when, as so many people who get on this journey start, I got a dog with behavioral issues, specifically reactivity, and then took kind of a hard right into all things training, dog training related, and kind of all things dog. I've been a lifelong dog owner, so always been passionate about dogs. One of the great joys of my life is definitely dogs. And then learning that there is this entire world dedicated to working with dogs was a huge revelation. Prior to Miss Chloe, I could not have told you how to get a dog to sit coming in as a blank slate. I worked with somebody for a little bit, and then we're still friends, but that training relationship ended and started to move more weirdly into TikTok because I did not have TikTok and I had never been on TikTok and I was like, ugh. But there were people who were only posting on TikTok about dog stuff. And so that is where I went. From TikTok, I found the Your Choice-Based Communication course and the R+ 2.0 collaborative around kind of sort of the same time. Took me a little bit to get started on the class. I was worried that I would need sort of a lot of time to dedicate to it, which ultimately I didn't, but that was why I waited. And so everything that sort of then started to happen around the same time was I think we were interacting about 2.0, about the course, and then discovered that there was all kinds of like geeky fun stuff that we were both interested in. I remember you sending me, I think the first article might have been on joint attention based on something Chloe had done. And then I think we went to derived relations and then to relational frame theory and like all kinds of stuff. And it has been so much fun to dive into that. And I'm super excited to keep that conversation going.
It was a very fast friendship. Absolutely. I think immediately we got into that info sharing exchange and quickly learned that we share passions for learning more, for animals, for all of this really fun stuff. And I want to kind of also mention your background and education in part of the things that we really connected on coming from the R+ 2.0 collaborative, where we were talking about kind of moving beyond our current view of learning theories. We talk a lot about behaviorism in animal training, but we don't talk about other theories and concepts around the experience of learning that are well established in humans. Things like constructivism, cognitivism are usually tossed aside because we don't feel that we have ways to really get the information we need from animals, right? And we're working really hard on that. We talk a lot about it in 2.0, but I remember one of the first things that we really connected on in the R+ 2.0 community was a discussion around constructivism. And you'd mentioned that you had learned so much of it in your master's program.
Yeah, I was so excited when the light bulb went off that the learner-centeredness and constructivism that were part of the materials I was looking at were the same things that I had learned in school and then have practiced for quite a while in higher ed. I went to grad school for the program is called like College Student Personnel. I was looking back at some articles in a book the other day, and it goes through all the same things that are the foundations of this stuff. So I think that that helped me dive in with a foundation. But then the thought of everything that has been covered in the research and discussed since then, and then also applying it to dogs, whole new world. So exciting.
Certainly a whole new world, but it's been so much fun to explore and to explore in a sense of curiosity and sort of openness to the possibility, because these things are not well established in our training world and our training literature. We don't have a lot to back these things, but we can see that there are parallels that exist. And if we explore the possibility, it's brought so much just amazing and interesting thoughts to these discussions, both in 2.0 and definitely amongst ourselves. And so at least for me, the motivation for this podcast was to have a space to really dump those thoughts into, right? To have a space to talk about those questions, to explore them a little bit, get a little more in depth, break them out of the confines of just my own brain. And I'm so excited to explore that with a friend, to have you here. I think you bring such amazing insights of your own from your own background and experience in this. And as a contrast of being the dog guardian perspective, coming through training and various methodologies and strategies, and having a dog who is reactive, which is a struggle and such a common one, and your experiences in all of those things is going to help us have really well-rounded discussions, I hope, and really engaging conversations for others to listen to. So I'm so excited about this.
Me too. I think I represent the group that has to Google a lot, but is super excited about it. So we have kind of a newbie coming in, and then someone who has thought a lot about this stuff. And I'm excited to explore all of it.
I have thought a lot about this stuff, but I would be lying if I said that I don't Google things every single day. So I want everyone listening to know that, just because sometimes we will be, you know, tossing around some words or concepts that you might not have heard before. The goal is not that we're, you know, sitting here throwing jargon around to be fancy or to, you know, be really academic about it, but to dive into some of the nuances around complex concepts and things that maybe aren't widely understood, or the application and possibilities are not well explored. And so it's not, you know, just to be confusing or confounding in any way. If you have to Google, so do we all the time. There are things that I come across that I don't know anything about. And it's just become a passion now every time I hear something I don't know. It's so exciting to me. I hope that we can create a space that feels welcoming, to kind of encourage with an open mind, where that is impossible, just doesn't exist in the conversation, where we're not shutting things down and we explore the maybe boundaries of what might be possible by trying to try them out and see what happens, and explore the ideas or the thoughts or the questions around them without judgment, and welcome others into that space with us too.
Yeah, I think for me, this really represents the start of a conversation. I have been searching just absolutely everywhere for content about this, including articles, YouTube, social media, podcasts, all kinds of things. And people don't seem to be talking about this the way that you are, the way that we are. And the more of us that come into the conversation, the more it can develop. So I think hopefully we are starting a conversation here.
Absolutely. And that is part of the goal behind my motivation to build the R plus 2.0 community, which is really meant to be this space to welcome ideas, to bring other things in, was because I felt similarly that there are people that have really fascinating thoughts about giving animals choice and agency and communication. And what does that mean? And what do we pull from parenting and human education, and great ideas that certainly I haven't had, and things that I've been obsessing over for years as well. And how do we create a space where we can all be talking about these things, where we can start to push that further? And so if anyone, you know, is listening to this and wants to be part of these discussions, that is really the place to go. That's really where we're having this as a group, as we're exploring these things, really working through them. This podcast is just for you and I to really explore these things in depth that we geek out about back and forth with. But absolutely, anyone who wants to join in on these discussions, there is a venue to do that.
Absolutely. And it's a very welcoming venue. And I can say that confidently as a dog mom who came in intimidated, but was very, very quickly welcomed and feel very much part of the community.
I'm so glad. We're so lucky to have you. You've become such an integral part for that. Absolutely. As with everything. But kind of circling back to our origin story, I want to kind of explain to others, not just, you know, that we bonded over these things and bonded very quickly, but what some of these things are that really fueled this journey. And that really brought us together. Circle back to Chloe. I remember the first consult where you reached out and had explained that you were doing all these things. You were doing all the things that we typically recommend with reactivity, and felt that you could manage most of the time her reactivity very well. You live in a dense urban environment. That's an accomplishment by any measure. But that there were still times where you know, maybe somebody popped out of a door unexpectedly. And if you can't stay one step ahead of your dog, then what are you left with when you're trying to kind of play catch up in those situations? It feels like all of that great progress that you make goes out the window. How do you anticipate and change things you can't control in that way? Thing that really was the catalyst for creating these discussions, diving into these discussions, feeling like there was a piece missing in how we're addressing behavioral concerns. And that there has to be a strategy out there that exists because we do it with humans. We have so many different ways that we deal with behaviors and emotions in humans that we are not doing as many nuanced versions of with animals. And so the basic foundation, it felt like you were such a great fit for what we were trying to do, which was at its very core, wondering if your dog could tell you in those moments of stress where something was happening unexpectedly, where you couldn't anticipate it, what they needed from you to be able to successfully get through that. Would you be doing what they're asking for? Would they ask for what you're already doing? Or would they ask for something totally unexpected? And in that way, are we supporting them in the best way that we can? And if we can take that input, even in times where we can't control what's happening around us, can we better navigate it? Can we help them to cope in ways that are more successful? And I've found so often that it is the latter, but that the strategies that we're using to do that, to gather input to get to a communication, are things that are not being discussed elsewhere. And that's where you and I really started to dive in and geek out about the joint attention. You know, how are we getting this feedback from the animals and using that to our advantage?
Yes. As someone who, as I mentioned, could not have told you how to get a dog to sit, having, you know, I had a few months of kind of more standard training type things, operant training in particular, under my belt, but to be so new to it and realize that dogs look at things in order to get me to look at things or you to look at things because they want something, and what that means for communication, to have all that, to have sort of the practical realization and the theoretical realization all at the same time, was super cool. And we know a lot about the role that agency plays in distress and tolerance in humans. And it made total sense to me from the beginning that that would be true for dogs as well. Why not? Knowing that it's very well established in behavioral science. And then having watched it now with Chloe and seen it play out, where I think a month and a half, maybe 2 months into this system, choice-based communication, totally bought in and have learned so much about the ways that not the ways that so much about the things that she needs from me that I would absolutely never have gotten if she couldn't have told me, which makes me think about all the ways that we collectively, with the best of intentions, control our dogs' lives.
It's a deep rabbit hole, certainly, to go down. And coming from those previous experiences, is there something that kind of stood out in what you saw that made you go, hey, I want to try this?
Honestly, it's a pretty kind of basic answer, but I mentioned lifelong dog owner, have always been super passionate about dogs. And so when I saw something that would empower a dog to communicate with me about what they needed, I was sold right there. I was like, if you want to have a system whereby a dog can communicate what they need, I'm in. Reactivity or no, I think I would have been in. But then I had hit kind of a point where I was managing, but things were not changing, a plateau, if you will. And I felt like the concept of Chloe being able to better express what she needed, because I still didn't even know at that point, close to a year in, what was underlying her reactivity. Was she wanting to get to the dog? Was she wanting to run away from the dog? What were the issues? And I still didn't know. And I had worked with trainers and I still didn't know. And so I felt like I could get so much information from that basic question all the way over to, you know, I would later learn how she prefers to be managed. Getting all of that information in order to actually help her and not just manage her. That was really, I mean, I started just at being curious about what she would tell me if she could, and it evolved into so much more.
I don't think that's a basic answer, at least not for the rest of, you know, everyone listening to this. But
I think being curious about what a dog would tell you if they could is maybe, if not universal, a fairly common experience of like, what could a dog tell me? And I think that was where I started. And then it snowballed into everything else.
Totally. I think that we don't give enough credit to dog owners in what they want out of their relationships with their dogs. We frequently say they want the quick solutions, they want quick answers. And in many ways, I think the really interesting contrast about the system is that it provides both. It is meant to be easier and simpler for dog owners. They don't have to memorize body language. They don't have to learn the nuances of the narratives that we're feeding them about why things are happening, but they just get to ask your dog questions and your dog answers, and it turns into a conversation. It's meant to be simple. It's meant to cater to all of those needs in a way.
And it really quickly goes from being somewhat formulaic in terms of, you know, dog does X, I do Y, and that's how we communicate, to being something that is just happening naturally on a walk. I think, I don't remember where this comparison came from, but like driving a car, like you could suddenly realize, or you start out needing a lot of guidance in terms of learning how to drive. And then one day you have driven somewhere and you couldn't tell someone how you got there. You're not paying attention to putting the car in drive and backing up beyond what you need to do to be safe, but it's no longer quite so formulaic. And it's been a similar experience where now we go out and we're just going back and forth about what she wants and what I want and what we're going to do. And it got to be pretty natural really quickly. And of course, we have added to the system, which is the other cool part, that you don't kind of continue to need someone to tell you, if you want to have her do this, you need to do this. You can start to figure out yourself how to build communication with your dog about what they want based on what they have told you, based on what the dog has indicated.
That's one of my favorite pieces. And it's not just because empowering the dog is really freaking cool, but also empowering people so that, you know, you can have these relationships that feel like relationships. They don't feel like you need somebody coaching you on how to get along with your dog or how to support your dog the whole time. You're learning from each other. And in many ways, I love it when I become absolutely unneeded. You don't need me anymore. You tell me exactly what your dog is saying. You know it all. It's my favorite piece of it. One of the bits that you had kind of talked about, even if you weren't dealing with reactivity, you'd still want to know what your dog was saying. But I think for people who are dealing with reactivity, it can feel very strange, the idea of giving your dog choices. It feels synonymous with freedom, which can feel really unsafe. Why are we giving a dog that, you know, is freaking out at things, especially in an urban environment where we already feel like we have so little control? Why would we give up some of the control that we have? And we're not giving it up. I think that is something that's really hard to understand from the outside. It's very hard to observe in any videos of this process or to look at this process and think, even from seasoned trainers, that we know what's going on, because it is not what it looks like. It is individual to everyone. But in experiencing this, did you ever feel unsafe?
So at first, I had a pretty easy time handing over control to her. I was ready to do it. We did it. She was making excellent choices. And then we had an experience that was just like, you know, reactive dog humans, just nightmare. So it was raining, which is always an issue for her. There were, I think, two dogs that passed her in really close proximity, one of them running toward her with the human, people running at her is already like, it was just her, some of her biggest triggers back to back to back, and just explosions. And for a little bit after that, she was struggling, and I saw that she was struggling. And my inclination was to start to manage more, to start to take choices away from her so that she didn't tip over into reactions, trying to protect her from sort of the aftermath of that experience. And a little bit later, I realized that in doing that, I had in fact taken those choices away, and I had sort of, I was impeding the system and impeding her choices. And that was continuing the cycle of her getting stuck and reacting more often rather than helping. So that inclination to pull back on control ended up being something that was not helpful. I understand why it happened. I think it's a natural reaction on the human's part to want to do that. But I did eventually see that then I was the problem, which is so often true, right? The human. But yeah, so I did have that experience of sort of trying to take the control back, feeling, I don't know, unsafe, but definitely uncomfortable. And then having to really stretch back into trusting her the way that I had before. And things got better pretty quickly from there.
It is so hard. It's so relatable, right? We're trying with the best intentions. And so I know you said humans are so often the problem. And I want to add some nuance to that, because I know people are going to hear that and it feels horrible to think that way. And we don't mean it in the sense that you're causing your dog's reactivity or anything like that. You're not. But sometimes there's this like one directional relationship that's happening where we come in and we think we know the best way to support. It's almost like coming in and telling someone just relax, right? You're trying to help, but it's not helpful. And sometimes it can maybe make things, you know, just a little harder on your dog, and you're not trying to do that. And we absolutely recognize that. And so the idea is sort of judgment-free, coming in and looking with constructive lenses on what we're doing and the feedback that we're getting from our dogs, and taking that without it being a judgment on how we are doing things or that we are trying to do them with kindness. But if our dogs are saying to us, you know, I really don't like it when you step up into my space and shove food in my face while I'm looking at a trigger, then it gives us information that we can use to better reach our goals. And how can we make it easier on both of you? How can we align both of your needs? How do we need to manage to feel safe? And how do we need to give a little bit of leeway, or the right kind of leeway, so that it is safe and the dog is less likely to tip into a reaction as well? And those are tough things to navigate. Absolutely. And you're doing so exceptionally well. And also, I should mention documenting your journey on TikTok and sharing those videos to everyone's benefit. It's amazing to see Chloe's progress and to see even those moments where things aren't coming together, because it is such a roller coaster always.
Yeah. And thank you for that clarification. Definitely. I think about I'm the one who kind of needs to take primary responsibility for what I'm doing with her, but fault isn't necessarily kind of a part of that equation. It's all about taking in information and adjusting. So thank you for that. And yeah, documenting the journey. The whole reason that I started to post on TikTok instead of just continuing to lurk was to be a part of conversations. And so I think if we're going to have conversations, they should be honest ones. And so I try to show the difficult moments as well as the little triumphs that, you know, anyone who's worked with a dog with a behavioral issue knows the roller coaster. So I try to show both the highs and lows.
Absolutely. I mean, just with anything, we all have our bad days. We all have days where we can't handle the same amount of things. And that's one of the reasons that I particularly like this system, because there are so many things, and I want to hear your experience with this, and I'm going to ask about it too. So I'll give you a second to think about it, is that we talk a lot about concepts and reactivity, things like threshold, right? Or we have these ideas of what it is that our dog can and cannot handle, and yet they seem to change day to day. And so how do we start to get more accurate information about on this day, when it's raining, when there are triggers out, how do you feel about going farther on your walk? Or where would you like to go on your walk? Would you rather just take a quick pee and go right back inside? How do we get those questions or that information from our animals so that if there's a day where they are not equipped, we know that in advance? We are not discovering that by going out on these long walks and having these big reactions and experiencing those, which can be really challenging as well. Or how do we get information about how you might want to be better managed in those situations so that we're not adding to that? So I know you've had a number of experiences that have kind of changed some perspectives on how you interact with Chloe. Are there any that are like really sticking out to you?
Oh man, there are so many. This is such a big topic. And obviously, like any dog owner, I could talk about my dog all day. Yeah, definitely how I manage her has changed. And it has been a little challenging to establish the balance between when she's in the lead and when I am, when she's talking, when I'm talking, because I do really want to trust her on these walks and identifying that moment when we switch from I'm just looking and I can handle this to please help. We're still kind of living into that, but it has gotten a lot better. And one of the things that I realized pretty early on, I think it was in the first week, was I had shared a video and you showed me in such a way that I identified for myself, or felt like I did, that when I stepped toward her, to get her into a magnet hand. And so I stepped toward her and had my hand out with the food was when the reaction actually started. And I have learned that she does not enjoy that. So I will now err a little bit on the side of a little bit sooner calling her name. And if she looks back at me, we go into kind of a management thing and she comes to me voluntarily rather than me getting in her space. Alternatively, we'll just go walk a different direction. And sometimes she's in charge of that. And sometimes I am, but I used to shove food directly into her face a lot. And I hardly ever do that anymore because it doesn't seem to help her. Cause I saw that several more times after that video. I've seen it pretty frequently when I've tried to do that. So I don't really use that technique much anymore because it doesn't seem to help her.
That's totally fair. And I think it's kind of a common experience around dogs that there are maybe certain things that they need to cope. And when we're trying to, you know, make them cope in a certain way, if it's not aligning with that, how is that contributing to whatever experience they're having internally? We don't get to know all the details and nuances around that. We might get a very simple, yes, this is helping, or no, we don't get to know why. But if we can ask those very basic questions of, okay, well, what might be helping, without necessarily experimenting on them, but allowing them to lead and guide, that can be really helpful in doing so efficiently, which is scary, I think, for a lot of people to take that leap in trying to get feedback from their dog, or if anyone is, you know, very convinced that they know what their dog is experiencing around the triggers and that what they're doing is helpful for their dog. The dogs have humbled me in that experience through this.
Yes, I never assume that I know, because it does, at first it felt like her thresholds went haywire. And now I'm like, well, what's a threshold? Like, what does it depend on? Because Chloe gets to decide what her thresholds depend on. And so for one person, it's going to be 2 feet, and another person, it's going to be 50. There was an experience we had today, actually, where, or yesterday, but where Chloe we were walking forward and somebody started to walk toward us. And I'm a little bit on Chloe's left. She's on my right, and she looks back at me over her right shoulder. So away from the person walking toward us, but toward me to indicate to continue going forward. She was uncomfortable with that person, I think, or she would have, she always looks over her left shoulder because that's where I am, but she still made that intentional choice to want to move forward. And I think that she usually is looking over that left shoulder. She's fine. She's comfortable to move forward. Something about this, she was a little uncomfortable, but she still wanted to go. In contrast, there's somebody who lives near me that has a dog, and something about this dog, Chloe will typically want to sit and watch forever, sit and sniff forever after a dog goes by. Reaction or no, she wants to process time. She wants that process time. This dog, you cannot get her out of there fast enough, and she will communicate that. If she sees it soon enough, she wants to go the other way. I would have had no real concept of her wanting to, her motivations changing when she sees one dog versus another prior to this.
Yeah. And that really ties into the management piece, right? If we are kind of keeping you in place and the dog is aware that something is approaching that they would really rather get away from, or, you know, we feel like our escape options are limited, being able to open the door to, you know, what direction would you like to escape in, that small piece of control, it doesn't mean that you get to go up and engage with triggers or do anything like that. You just get to control little pieces that are negotiable, does so much for their ability to not only cope, but to tell us at an earlier point too, that they might see the dog, you know, way far away, or sense it before we even are even aware that it's there, and turn us the other direction and get us to go away. How empowering that must feel for them.
Absolutely. There, I am better at spotting triggers when they are far away, but within sight, and Chloe is better at spotting them before I can see them. So if they're around a corner, she hears them, she smells them, whatever it is. And I've been really leaning into, if she gives the slightest indication that anything's up at a corner, we're just going to pause a second. We're going to see what she wants to do, because she might know something I don't.
And that's such a hard thing to grasp, I think, as humans. We think we are, you know, we're intellectually superior, we've got all these skills, we know about the risks of things and what you can and cannot handle, dog. And so to kind of lean back and trust that input goes against our instincts quite a bit. It can be really challenging at first, but it is fascinating what they do end up telling us as they start to get empowered with some ways to make choices. And sometimes at first, those choices are starkly different from what we'd expect, right? They come outside and they sit and they want to watch the world, and we think they would like to go walking everywhere. And that's just not what they're telling us in that moment. So being able to not just kind of adapt to the idea that thresholds are, they make no sense anymore, which I can completely relate with, is also what we think we know about what they want changes often too. And we're doing our best to try and fulfill those things, but it's such a crazy dance trying to keep up with those many changes and complexities of who our dogs are and what they want as another sentient being in our lives.
Absolutely. I also think it's important to note, I know a common concern when people first start to hear about this system and some of these concepts is, well, what happens when you have to say no to the dog? Because you can't let the dog do everything. For instance, Chloe doesn't understand what a crosswalk is. And so sometimes she is like, yes, let's go forward. And I'm like, you're going to get run over. So we stop. And the point, though, for me is that it doesn't seem to bother her. It doesn't seem to stop her from using the communication system, because a little bit of agency goes so far, particularly when you don't have any, but also when you're confronted with something that scares you or that makes you nervous or that's otherwise uncomfortable. We know in humans, being able to control proximity, the speed toward the thing, all of those things matter so much. And why would it be different for dogs? And so just because sometimes we have to go the way that I want to go, or she's not done with the walk, but I need to get to work, whatever it is, doesn't bother her. And she, Chloe specifically anyway, comes along quite agreeably. But I know that I've heard from you and others that they have similar experiences, that it isn't as though you say no one time and they're just like, well, never mind then. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you brought it back to the research in humans, because this is something we talk about so often and we'll dive into great detail with. But there is so much research that shows that not only does having agency, and we should probably define that, agency being my preferred definition, is that sense of control over your circumstances. And that doesn't mean, you know, absolute freedom to control every part of your circumstance, but the sense that you get to influence something about it is a very powerful experience. And that may or may not involve choice, and that may or may not involve freedoms of a certain degree. Those things are relevant and adjacent to the concept of agency, but they're not the only piece of agency. They're not synonymous with it. That sense that we can decide when to get closer is a huge factor behind engaging with historically aversive events. And we see that in humans, that humans will choose to, in the face of scarce or non-existent reinforcement, continue to engage with aversive activities because of a sense of agency, or persist despite continuing punishment and adversity to a long-term goal of achieving reinforcement when they feel that they have agency. And it seems to be very consistent with what we're seeing with dogs as well, and something that could have so many great implications if we looked more into how we can harness this stuff.
And that long-term reinforcement, not meaning, you know, she gets a treat at the end of getting past the trigger, more so meaning that she continues to have that control and agency, and that it is serving her need in that moment as to getting closer, further away, taking a left, taking a right, and knowing that I will be predictable in doing what she is asking me to do in those moments.
Yes. Yes. That's such an important piece. The rate at which we lean on food versus things that give agency. I think those are something that is a whole other episode in and of itself, is the discussion of how food and positive reinforcement are, of course, very kind, but also can inhibit agency, because we use it to talk over the things that are valuable to you, to override them, to say, do this for food. Maybe if you wanted a different alternative, you won't say that if this is valuable enough, or to add value to things that already have value, and then we're not measuring how valuable they are. So functional reinforcement and the value of just achieving these outcomes and achieving and accessing more agency is what perpetuates communication. It's what perpetuates this sort of relationship. And it's so cool to watch how you guys have developed it and how you have such a deep grasp of these concepts as well. I think it's going to really help people to maybe take the leap and explore some of these concepts with their dog, because it can be daunting, I think, to imagine giving dogs a sense of control, or a dog that is barking at the end of the leash, a sense of control. Did you have feelings about that one?
About giving Chloe control?
Yeah.
I kind of didn't. I actually was like pretty willing to do it. And I'm an outlier in that, you would know better than I do. But after that moment that I described with like the massive trigger stacking, after that, I did have that experience, but not up front. Up front, I was like, let's do this. Let's see what she wants to do. And we headed right outside and she made really amazing choices and the surprising information came out of it. And it was so immediately reinforcing for me that I didn't actually have a lot of space for doubt right up front, but then later did experience that like, oh crap, this might mean that like, I still need to figure some things out, or I am really inclined to like jump back in and try to protect her, which was not what she needed. And then I did have to learn that then.
It's not uncommon. I say all the time that as reactive dog owners, we have our own emotional responses to their behavior. It's not just that we're treating their reactivity. We're treating and going through almost a therapeutic process in healing from their reactivity as well and not anticipating it and the trauma of those reactions that it gives us truly. Hearing the dog even when you don't have the dog with you, right? Like wanting to dodge behind things or check for things when you're not even walking your dog. It's a very real experience. And so it makes perfect sense that after kind of having another experience that was jarring or not expected after you had tried some of those strategies would take you back to that place. I think that's extraordinarily relatable.
Yeah, it was just such a such an overwhelming situation for her. And I saw coming out the next day that she was still stressed. And so I think for maybe a couple minutes, I was still like, okay, no, use the system. And then it was clear that she was struggling. And I was like, well, I'm just going to help. and that was still pretty early on. And I think now I would know a little bit more. I would know different ways to listen to her now, even than what I did then. And I can think of some different things that I could have done to empower her rather than take away choices by just trying to stick food in her face. So live and learn. And I definitely did eventually have that like, oh man, this is tough experience.
That's so fair. It's so fair. And it is tough. It's not perfect. Nobody's perfect. But what were some of those, if you're willing, some of those things that you feel maybe you would have done differently?
Yeah. I mean, I think it boils down to asking the dog questions, but let me try and kind of operationalize that. I mean, the first big thing that I would have done was just slow way down. And so we had a pace that we had kind of established, and I think I would have done a lot more stopping and checking in and sort of, are you sure you want to do that? You're saying you want to do that. Let me just check. Or, okay, you said you want to go forward, but you look a little anxious. Let me just turn my feet and see what that does. Do you want to go that way? Just asking her a lot more about what she, double checking what she wanted to do and asking questions about whether she really wanted to do that. To reinforce for her that I will do what she says. And after having an experience of kind of loss of control, you have control, my friend Chloe, like you can still tell me what to do and I will follow your lead, but I'm also going to maybe ask you some questions about it. The other thing has to do with so I mentioned that I started like kind of shoving food back in her face. And that also came a little bit from a place of, I was thinking maybe she wanted food. She missed food on the walks. And then we had this experience. And so I'm bringing food back in. Now she has a way to ask me for food on walks. And so I think I would have thought a little bit about where my motivation was coming from actually to reintroduce food. And then also if I'm thinking that maybe she needs some more management help with food, she is capable of, you know, quote unquote, saying, communicating to me that she would like food to get through this interaction. She can tell me that. I don't have to shove it in her face for it to happen. So asking her more questions and double checking her answers a little bit with just some time to process, because for my particular dog, processing time is huge for her. She loves to sit and process. So I am pretty confident that asking her to sit and process would not be damaging in any way to her, wouldn't have a negative consequence. She would just either stare at me like, yeah, I'm sure, or she'd sit down and stare and that would be fine for her. So I feel like either of those outcomes is acceptable. And I would have done a lot more of that.
Yeah, I love all of those. And particularly because I think a big misconception about giving choices is that it's sort of reactionary, right? That the choices coming in, like when the animal has already seen a trigger, and then we're asking them, now what do you want to do? And it really is more often meant to be proactive. And it's meant to identify when a problem is happening far sooner than we would ever see with reactive behavior, because usually we're seeing it once the body language starts to show that they're distressed. We're not getting a sense of when the thoughts are going off the rails a little bit. And so what you're describing, those asking questions sooner, is a piece that I feel is really potent and something that can be harnessed in so many other circumstances with our dogs, of really being proactive about questioning, what are you doing? How are you doing? Why are you making this decision? Is there something in the distance? If there's something there, can you reaffirm that decision for me? Can you tell me that, yes, you saw that and you're sure you'd like to move closer? And then you've gone three steps closer. And are you sure you want to keep moving closer? And as they continue to make these affirmative decisions, we can be a lot more certain and relaxed in their confidence in entering those situations, and can be a little bit less on guard with our management because we're less likely to be surprised.
Absolutely. Chloe is part beagle and she definitely has the nose part. And so frequently her nose is on the ground and I have no idea if she has seen the thing that is approaching us. And so when something starts to approach us now, we stop and I wait until she has seen the thing and can tell me that she wants to move forward. At least in certain contexts, I do that. So yes, the asking the question, the making sure that they are sure, all of that. Yep.
Yeah. It's so interesting, especially with, the video, I think it was maybe 2 weeks in, where there were three triggers back to back. And it's such a good example that you have of this, of Chloe looking ahead, seeing a guy putting stuff in the van, processing for a while, normal, and he's doing his thing and deciding with such certainty, like, yes, I'd like to keep going. And not just in her decision to say, yes, I'd like to get closer, but in the ways that she continuously actively moved you every step of the way, of staying near you, kind of driving you forward and checking in frequently and watching the thing. Her nose wasn't on the ground. She wasn't distracted during that approach. Every step she's watching the guy and actively choosing to move you, coordinate you closer. And that level of attention in the activity and the choices that they're making, intention in what they're choosing, is something that I think is often lacking from the ways that we address reactivity. We look at, you know, counter conditioning, for example. We're at a distance, we're offering you treats, and maybe you're looking and you're doing okay, but we're making a lot of assumptions. And when we make a lot of assumptions, there's a lot of room to be wrong and a lot of room to get surprised by those things. So I personally, my favorite thing about it is clarity, because I don't like to wonder. And in that way, I feel that that idea of giving agency feels like a loss of control when we think about it conceptually broadly. But when we look at the ways that we're applying it, that feels like so much more control to me than anything I've previously done with reactive dogs.
Yes. So when we were first starting, just the first couple of days, I kept repeating to myself that clarity is kindness. Just that was what came into my head, because it can feel you're trying to give agency, but you're having to make the structure clear, and that can cause some cognitive dissonance a little bit. And so that, yeah, relatable to just the, like, the clarity is key to the system kind of working. And once it's in place, it helps so much. So progress isn't linear. It isn't like every single time is perfect, but I do see, you mentioned kind of the amount of time that she needed to look at the guy in the van. The amount of time that she needs to do that threat assessment is decreasing, definitely overall. And that would be the goal, right? Is to actually resolve the emotions and have her understand that her perception of what's threatening is a little off. And so I do see that very much starting to happen, that she's able to do that. So it's working.
That is such an interesting piece. We come into that, I think, with such a judgment, right? Of your wrong dog. And so then our strategies surround trying to tell them they're wrong and show them why they're wrong. Instead of kind of honoring, okay, this is how you're feeling. And if that's your reality, then how do we navigate that reality and then come from that place down? And so that is a really big catalyst behind the design of the system, is that never sat well with me. And I said it a million times. I will own up to that. I said it. I taught it. I taught thresholds. I've taught all of these things. And it still never, I had cognitive dissonance for a very long time around it. And coming into these sort of strategies, the piece that I find really fascinating about it is that there are different measures. Obviously, progress is not linear, but we see things pretty quickly change as well in their tolerance of triggers. By getting just answers and how they would like to respond differently, we rapidly decrease the rate and intensity of reactions pretty quickly. That doesn't mean that it's perfect by any means, but it gives us a whole new baseline to start from. And then from there, the changing of the emotions piece, it becomes a very different process. It's not the same as our expectations of it being a very systemic and repetitive process, there is a piece that we don't talk about in animal training. And that's that cognitive element, the possibility of a cognitive element. And I talk about this in the first episode of cognitive distortions and giving time to process the triggers, getting time to look at them. A lot of times with management, we give them a second or two to look and then we're guiding them away with treats. And when your experiences with your trigger are consistently very short, very limited, you're never really creating information that it gets logged in a database in your brain to compare it to if there is an incorrect threat assessment happening, something to actually kind of adjust that based on. And so it's so interesting to see, not only did we give her time and she took a lot of it at the beginning, which is totally normal. We see a lot of dogs do that, but that time to stare wasn't tipping her into a reaction. She was taking it in. And now going from her own volition, not us saying you can't have that time to process any longer, but her saying I don't need that time to process any longer feels monumental. I think that is such a massive measure of something really shifting inside.
Absolutely. We, a couple hours ago, went on our longest walk to date, and it was all her, and she wanted to go to the busiest area of town. And I was like, okay. And so we did, and the number of people that she was able to kind of look up at them a little bit, look back at me like, okay. And she was all right. And it was, you know, 3 to 5 seconds of processing rather than the full like 3 minutes or whatever that she needed for that first guy with the van. And that re-regulation, resetting of her threat assessment is really cool to see.
That is fascinating. And the lack of trigger stacking that seems to happen in these situations as well. When they are making the choice to go near a trigger, it doesn't seem to have the same cost to them as enduring triggers that they don't have any agency around. That's not to say that they get to go up and interact with these people, but they get to just, you know, choose to walk by them or to interact to the safest degree with that dog. So if you have a dog you're worried about, you know, a bite history with, that might be across the street and pass. And that's okay too. But allowing them to choose, you know, the point at which you cross the street or the distance at which they want to turn around, those little pieces seem to have such a massive effect on that recovery time.
Yeah. And that makes me think about how it's not just sort of choosing between continuing forward or turning around. If going forward isn't the thing that they want to do, they can choose anything. I mean, that we don't believe is unsafe, but they can choose so many things beyond choice A and choice B. And so often these conversations, even with management or other types of kind of rehabilitation, if you will, are really based around, you know, choice A and choice B. And one of the things that I like so much about this is that it really opens kind of the whole world of possibilities for her because it is based in communication and not just this or that.
Yes. And it's such a hard piece to fathom because when we talk about communication, everybody thinks language, they think speaking, right? Not just a conveying of information, just a two-way, you know, wire of information. And we know that dogs have the capability to do that. There are different ways in which they do that. There are two primary ways that we focus on in this sort of system. The first is man's, which is the ability to kind of request something of your own volition. You're motivated by something, you ask, it happens. And we see that in dogs when we teach them to use bells to go outside or to sit by their bowl to ask for a refill or to sit by the treat container because they would like a treat from there. We start to see that based on the outcomes that are associated with a particular gesture, behavior, whatever it may be, that they start to understand if I would like that outcome, then if I do this behavior, and then it initiates that outcome. And so in that way, they are communicating with us. They are saying, I would like this to happen. We don't always have to honor every single one. I think that's a misconception. In the same way that every time your child asks for ice cream, you don't have to say yes. They still know how to ask for ice cream and will do it when they want to. That is that really interesting resistance to adversity piece that we see in communication. the other piece of it, the introverbal piece, is that response to questions. So when you stop and you're not quite honoring, and they are almost continuously manding, they are answering a question we've asked of like, oh, we've stopped, you know, are you going to give me the same signal? Are you going to answer my question and tell me what you'd like to do next? And there are a number of different ways that we can incorporate that sort of strategy too. So in that way, in all of this, there's a great deal of information and theory from a science perspective, and that being the highest order of, you know, accolade that we can give to a scientific idea, very different from hypothesis, where it's, you know, we're guessing and we're still getting the data. The theory is well backed at this point, that this is how we teach communication, and there are a variety of ways to go about that. The most fascinating piece, and I know you mentioned it earlier, is in doing so, in modeling it after what we know about communication and teaching communication, especially under adverse conditions where maybe communication isn't developing at the expected rate in humans, or there are physical limitations to how we communicate, you know, with speech, and we're looking at alternative ways of conveying information. When we apply those same principles to animals, we're seeing them develop communication that we haven't directly taught. And there are answers for that as well, and things that we will certainly get deeper into. But I love the examples already that we've seen with Chloe, things that we would never have thought to ask, things like using the joint attention that we talked about at the beginning to guide you to have some lap time, which was unfathomable. Do you want to share that story? Because I think it's just the coolest freaking thing.
Yeah, I do. I also want to talk about how the system is generalized to other contexts, because I was thinking about that too. But that is probably my favorite thing that has come out of this for Chloe and I, is that she asks for snuggle breaks when she is particularly stressed by the environment, less so like specific triggers, but more the birds are going or there's a loud bus or whatever. She just wants to like have a little snuggle time. And the first time that it happened, we had been having just a terrible walk. We had ended up in a spot that we aren't usually in, like several corners all together, and people come and go, dogs, the whole nine. And we just got really stuck. And so I made her kind of come back up the hill that we were on with me, and pulled over into a parking lot that is just totally inactive. And I sat on a curb and she sat next to me. She processed for a long time. And I was actually waiting for her to indicate that she wanted to move on, because I know she'll do that comfortably. And so I was waiting and waiting. We got up. I thought she was ready. We got up. We went maybe 10 feet and she turned me in a circle, took me back to that exact curb, exactly where I had been sitting, and sat her little butt down and waited for me to sit down too. And that is how I learned that that may have seemed like my idea, but I think it was a mutual construction kind of a thing.
I think it was. And in watching the video back, for anyone who wants to go look at it in your playlist, there are a couple little things that she does that mirror some of the things that we do in the system and the way that it is built, so that it can build into new ways to communicate. We want to give them some foundations to construct new things, because we may not know what outcomes they want. We need their help in designing communication so that we're not further limiting them. And so as she guided you back, when she first of all went to sit, it's interesting because she uses her body to guide your body, right? And so there could have even been some element of like, okay, I'm low now. You do what I do, because you move when I move. You move your feet. We turn, I turn, you turn. You're in some ways mimicking what she's doing. And if she has any idea that you're doing that, trying new things and having you then do them as well is at the very least reinforcing that idea, even if it was coincidental in that experience of you sit, I sit, you sit. But there was such an affirmative response as well. And the way that when she sat, she didn't look up at you to get you to start moving. She's staring down at that curb where you were just sitting until you sat down. And then the moment you sat down, she comes and gets in your lap and she's like loose and wiggly and happy to be there. And so it was almost that joint attention piece of, I've guided you over here. Now pay attention to this curb. Remember what you did here, Mom, sit down. And so it's fascinating. And again, I want to remind everyone that this podcast space, I know that this sounds like a lot of anthropomorphizing and I'm reading into her thought process, and I hear you and I agree with you. I am entirely doing that. I'm also basing it on a lot of information that I have about the science behind this stuff and what they could be going into, and data from Chloe specifically in which this has now presented multiple times and is not just a one-time situation where she has asked for this. And so we are seeing her pick up new man's new requests based on behaviors that she's done. Now, how she got to that process, that's the speculation of, was she thinking that when I do something, you follow? We don't know that bit, but it is certain that she has come up with a way to ask for more cuddles at this point.
Among other things, because you're right, we don't know what's happening in her brain, but all of the other information that we have tells us that it is intentional. This was not coincidental. And yeah, it's a fine line to anthropomorphizing, and I find myself walking it all the time because I just adore my dog. But also, there's a ton of concrete information that we'll get to later. But the generalizing piece is interesting too. The first time it happened had to do more with collaborative care, which is a kind of different topic, but all related to the concept of agency and dogs having control and being taught a system for having our actions mirror what they want. And she started to use a nose boop. She was kind of only quote unquote supposed to be using her eyes to communicate something, but she added a little flair to it. And it basically makes me stop. And so now there have been a couple of times when I've been either petting her or reaching to pet her that she has booped my hands, like, no, thank you, completely out of context of collaborative care. And then with the walks, there have been, you know, those times, anyone who has a dog, they sit there and they stare at you and they're whining and they're like, and you're just sitting there, what in the world do you need, dog? Like, tell me what you need. Well, I now have a way to ask, don't I? So I get up and I stand next to her the same way that I would if I had her on a leash. And she will guide me to what she wants. And so sometimes it's been food or a specific, like a treat over her kibble. And the one that really blew my mind was a specific toy, because she's not a dog that is particularly interested in toys. She had no interest when I first got her. So for her to get up and request to play with a specific thing was really, really cool. And we really didn't teach her to do any of that. We taught her to communicate, and it generalized seemingly effortlessly.
That is so cool. Nobody can see me right now, but I'm absolutely grinning about this stuff, because this is the stuff that excites me so much, is what can we learn beyond what we're asking? Because we know how to ask animals questions. We do that a lot. We do it in cooperative care. We ask you yes or no, can I start this? It's very different to give an animal the ability to start to express things unprompted and to do so with some clarity that we can really understand it with. There are a lot of dogs that and other animals that do this in many ways, right? They already naturally go pick up their water bowl and bring it to us when it's empty, or they find ways to communicate. So how we intentionally harness what we know about teaching those strategies to allow them to generalize really quickly, to create new ways of engaging with us, to show us what's important to them, opens up so many interesting ways of getting to know our animals as individuals, and their preferences and the things that maybe they would like, but they might have some perceived obstacles too, right? Like they just didn't know that they could get your attention to play with that toy, or it required so much effort before that they didn't try. And now they've got some strategies, and now it's more fun to get you to engage, or who knows what's going on there. That's the balance between anthropomorphizing and the science behind, we know they can communicate, but why? I am very aware of the times where I'm kind of speculating the thought process behind it. But if I never did that, if I always said, I cannot know what they're thinking, and therefore I can never question what could be the thought process behind it, and didn't try to brainstorm the possibilities, I would never have tried these strategies to see if there was something that they might want to say that we're not asking, and how would I ask that question? So we have to work our way back from that. So there is a fine line of harmful anthropomorphization, but also maybe things that we just don't know enough about yet. And how do we get to those strategies to ask those questions as well? Because that is so freaking cool that she took you to a specific toy. That is amazing.
Yeah, because we're not staying stuck at anthropomorphizing or sort of wondering about things. It's isolating variables and trying them out and all of that stuff. It's not sort of, well, I think it might be this, let me act as if it is this, with no further reflection. There's a lot more to it than that. I know that just from talking to you.
That is so true. Yes. And anyone else who knows me knows that I do not claim to know what dogs know. That is the thing that I will say to you over and over again, is I don't know your dog knows, and we're going to ask them, and I may be completely wrong. I will speculate, and I'm okay being completely wrong. Your dog will tell us. And that's what our goal is to figure out how to get that from them. And if we don't have the answer, we're going to figure it out. And we have come up with some really cool strategies. We're still exploring more of that in 2.0, but watching what the dogs come up with as well is just the thing that gets me so excited.
It's really, really cool. Yeah.
It is. And being able to kind of share this experience with others, but also geek out on the science of it. That's really what we're going to be diving into in this podcast bit. So it's not going to be just all about like, oh, we're playing with stuff and it's fun. It will be. Don't get me wrong. We'll share experiences on here. But the thing that you and I have certainly bonded over, we share a lot of studies. We talk a lot about different concepts and ideas that maybe seem totally wild and unrelated to animal training and how they might be made applicable, or what pieces could we take or what could we not, or how can we, you know, just maybe change some things in our industry or the way that we're doing things without judgment. It's not meant to say that any of the things that we're doing now are wrong, but that we are always on a process of evolution. And it is exciting to dive into those concepts. So I, for one, can't wait to dive into more of the deep science behind this stuff as well.
Totally agreed. I am super excited about it. I think anyone who enjoys thinking in the clouds a little bit is going to really enjoy this. And then we will certainly do our best to bring it back down to the practical level too. It's not my strong suit, but we'll try. Because everything is so interesting and there's so much to it. As I have gotten a foundation of, you know, a handful of concepts and then starting to understand how those concepts relate, it gets more and more interesting. So very excited to share the things that I have been learning, you've been thinking about for a long time, and how we each kind of view them coming from different places.
It's going to be great. I can't wait. For one, I can't wait to hear what everyone who hears this has to say about it as well. We have a long list of topics we want to get to. So whether or not we have any listeners, guys, we will continue to put things out because there's so much to talk about. But I'm so excited, and I'm so excited that you agreed to do this with me, because there's no way I could put this stuff out alone. And it's so much more fun to talk through these things with a friend and to have that equal shared excitement about it as we go through this. So thank you so much, Jen. I can't wait to do more.
Thank you. I'm so excited.